pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Everybody reaches for it.
Okay, the Secretary of Transportation will be joining us shortly, but he asked me to get the meeting started. And one housekeeping item in terms of how to use our computer. I'd like for Stephen to come up. There's one extra step we need to go through to
Good morning, board members. As you see on the new screen that we have set up, if you click on the PDF file, it will show up in your internet browser. That will be on your left-hand corner. So anytime you open up a PDF, it will show up in your left-hand corner in the internet browser. So remember that. That's where it's at now. All right, thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Our computers.
So one, we have our first item in Charlottesville, Albemarle MPO, and Stephen Williams.
Good morning. I'm Steve Williams. I'm the executive director of the Charlottesville Albemarle MPO, and I wanted to take just a moment at the beginning of my presentation to introduce a couple of members of the MPO Policy Board that have been able to join us today. You guys could please stand with me this morning. Kristen Zekas, the Vice Mayor of the City of Charlottesville, Rodney Thomas of the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors, and Dwayne Snow, who is the Vice Chair of the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors and the Chair of the MPO Policy Board. This morning, we'd like to speak to you about the ongoing partnership between the Charlottesville-Albemarle MPO and the Commonwealth Transportation Board, both about some things that we're working on now due to the collaboration that we've been working on, as well as some needs that we see coming in the Charlottesville area in future years. So just as an introduction, the Charlottesville metro area is really in the center of the state. We have a population of about 121,000, about 194 square miles. We have two localities, City of Charlottesville and Albemarle County, and there are two corridors of statewide significance which intersect in the region, I-64 and US 29. Some of our other primary highways are US 250, Virginia 20, Virginia 53, and Virginia 22. We also sit on two major railroad main lines. We have three transit systems. There are about 6 million transit rides served per year in the Charlottesville metro area. We actually have one of the highest rates per capita of transit ridership in the country in Charlottesville. We have about 26 miles of bike facilities and about 344 miles of sidewalk and pedestrian facilities. Our long-range transportation plan goal, and I think you'll see this as I go through the presentation this morning, is to plan for a fully integrated transportation system that allows people to choose from an array of modes and transportation options to meet their daily mobility needs. We would really like to express our thanks to you, and I know the same holds true for the members of the Policy Board that are here this morning, for the partnership that we have with the CTB and between the CTB and the MPO, and how that has enabled us to meet many of the local and statewide transportation system needs in the Charlottesville region. Several of our existing projects at the local level that are most important to us are what we call the Belmont Bridge, the US 29 to US 29-250 ramp, which is what we call the Best Buy ramp project, phase two of a project we call Hillsdale Drive, and completion of McIntyre Road Extended and the McIntyre Road Interchange at US 250. Just to quickly run through some of those projects, at the top you can see the Belmont Bridge. This is a vital north-south link within Charlottesville, and particularly between the south side of Charlottesville City and the downtown area. It's an aging bridge that spans the Buckingham Branch Railroad. With your help, this bridge is in the process of being replaced. It's currently in the design process, and we have an anticipated start date several years down the road for construction in 2018. The Best Buy ramp, or the US 29 250 ramp that I mentioned, is seen in the picture at the bottom. The project need is to reduce congestion and improve safety for traffic that is moving from 29 to the 29 250 bypass westbound. This project will add an additional lane on 29 onto the ramp and onto 250 29 westbound. It will improve safety by reducing problems that exist with the weaving of traffic up on 250, and we have an expected cost on that project of just over $11 million and a start date of 2015. Hillsdale Drive Extended is intended to provide local access to businesses in the 29 corridor, which will take traffic off of US 29 and reduce traffic on the corridor. Part of the roadway has been done, and that is the section that you can see in the picture at the top of the current slide. The final phase is under development and is currently in the right-of-way and design process with an expected start date of 2015. The Meadow Creek Parkway, McIntyre Road Extended, and McIntyre Interchange is partially done as well. This is the part in Albemarle County that extends up to Rio Road. This part was completed and opened in 2012. The McIntyre Road Extended section is currently under construction. The interchange will start construction during the coming year. We also have some existing projects on our corridors of statewide significance, and there are really two major projects that I'd like to call your attention to: the US 29 Western Bypass and the US 29 widening between South Fork, Ravana River, and Town Center Drive. And you can, Western Bypass is shown on the map at the right in sort of the light blue, and the 29 widening is shown in the darker blue color. The 29 Western Bypass will enable state and regional traffic to bypass the congested section of US 29 corridor within Albemarle County. It's to be constructed as a four-lane divided limited access highway. It'll extend about 6.2 miles between a location immediately north of the South Fork of the Ravana River and a location on the 29 bypass existing near the University of Virginia. The 29 widening will take place from the South Fork of the Ravana River up to Town Center Drive. It's a congested section of the roadway where the existing cross section necks down from six lanes to four. This will 1.1 mile widening will widen that section to six lanes and will also deal with some safety issues that are the result of limited sight distance in the area. As we're planning for future needs, we've been looking out at what, you know, kind of issues we expect to have in the future. And we've identified some of them here. We expect that we're going to need to make a fairly large expansion to our transit system in coming years because of growth that's taking place in the region. We are going to need to further develop our bike and pedestrian systems. We have some local road issues that we have to deal with, and we have some coming issues on those corridors of statewide significance that I'm going to get to here in just a moment. We wanted to call your attention to three particular areas of need that we expect and hope that we're going to be able to work with you on in the future. The first is regional funding mechanisms for local priorities. The second is a statewide funding mechanism for bike and pedestrian system improvements. And then two specific needs on our corridors of statewide significance: widening of the US 29 250 bypass and improvements to the I-64 US 29 interchange. In terms of the regional need, one of our most important needs going into the future is expanding our transit service. The map that you can see on the right shows all of our existing transit stops in the region overlaid on our 2010 population. As you can see in the statistics, about just short of half of the residents of the Charlottesville Albemarle area are currently within a quarter mile walk of a transit stop, and so they have good access to our transit system. By the time we get out to 2040, we're expecting that to drop to about 41% of our population. At the same time, right now, about 83% of our jobs are within a quarter mile of our transit system, but we expect that to drop to about 65% of the jobs come 2040. So one of our particular needs in the Charlottesville area is going to be to grow our transit system over the coming years. The biggest issue with regard to expanding the transit system is really new funding options. We've been encouraging the General Assembly to create local option funding approaches or mechanisms to help regions such as ours meet our priority needs. And we believe that if such funding options existed, that we would have the opportunity to meet our transit needs without the need to impact state resources, which we recognize are going to be limited going forward. So we think that a local option funding mechanism would be one of the most important things that could happen for our MPO and would allow us to meet our needs without burdening state resources. We hope that the CTB going forward would also be able to support those kind of local option funding mechanisms. A second need that we have at the local level is improving bike and pedestrian mobility. In a dense urban area like Charlottesville, bike and pedestrian mobility is a great way to meet people's mobility needs and take trips off of the roadways. This will help to reduce traffic congestion while helping to meet our local transportation needs. So our goal is to have a fully connected bike and pedestrian network within the Charlottesville area. The way we put it is that we hope that in the future in Charlottesville you'll be able to bike or walk anywhere that you could drive your car. We are concerned because of the changes that have taken place with regard to the federal funding mechanisms for bike and pedestrian funding under MAP 21. And we recognize that if those systems are ever to be developed to the point where they need to be to meet the needs that we have in Charlottesville, that there needs to be a broader funding mechanism. And so we hope that the CTB, the MPOs, and the General Assembly can get together and develop such funding mechanisms. And then finally, our regional needs on our corridors of statewide significance. And there are really two, but they're closely related. The first one is to widen the existing US 29 250 bypass between Barracks Road and I-64. And if you look at the map on the right, that's shown in sort of royal blue. At the very top of the map, you can see the southern end of the western bypass coming in. Part of that widening of that section will be dealt with, it's our understanding, as part of the Western Bypass Project. But data is showing that the section going south from the Western Bypass down to Interstate 64 will be significantly over capacity going into the future. Once it gets down to US 64, we have an existing interchange which is already starting to be impacted by congestion and safety issues, and we believe that as time goes by and traffic increases through that interchange, that the issues at the interchange will get worse all the time. This particular map shows what we're forecasting as level of service on that section of US 29 in 2040, and you can see that almost that entire section that I mentioned is either at level of service F or at level of service F minus. We expect this section will have very, very high levels of congestion for the great majority of the day going into the future. So our answer to that is to widen this section from four lanes to six lanes. That will require the reconstruction of three interchanges, and it will also, unfortunately, require changes to two locations where railroad bridges cross this particular section, which may actually be the most difficult part of this particular project. Once you get down to I-64, we have the interchange that I mentioned a moment ago. It moves traffic between I-64, which runs basically east and west, and US 29, of course, which runs north and south. We're already experiencing congestion and safety issues at that location, and you can see the statistics for crashes in recent years at this location. The interchange really needs to be reconstructed to provide free flow movements in all directions, which are not available at this point. So these are the needs that we see coming forward. We certainly appreciate the help that and support that the CTB has been giving to the Charlottesville-Albemarle metropolitan area with regard to our existing needs, and we look forward to working with you with regard to our future transit funding needs and statewide funding mechanisms for transit, bike ped, local options, and for our corridors of statewide significance. And so that is, I think, the completion of my presentation, but I would certainly be happy to respond to any questions that members of the board might have.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
As you've gone through your region comprehensively, I'm looking at a couple of different items. First of all, you've got you're calling for or asking for regional, local funding mechanisms to do that, and this is to do specific projects, sounds like secondary roads, things of that nature. It brings up the issue of devolution, and is that something that you guys are considering this to be a mechanism towards devolution of those secondary roads while the state focuses on primary and interstate? I ask that because, as you know, we're running out of revenues. The other element is you talk about specific programs or funding mechanisms for bike paths, pedestrian, talk somewhat on transit, and again, this gets to the issue of we don't have a lot of revenues coming in. In fact, we've got a diminishing base. The governor's put forward a package, a proposal. I know it's in the General Assembly going back and forth, but that proposal is to largely shift off what is a declining revenue stream, fuel tax, as cars get more efficient, people go to electric vehicles, to a sales tax mechanism. Is that something that you guys are supportive of, what the general constructs? There's always individual things that people are not, but the general construct of where the governor is going, and is it something where you see that as a future for the way we fund transportation in the Commonwealth, and you see it sounds like a greater role for local and regionals on some of these other secondary type roads?
Yeah. Well, and if I could, I'll address the second question first. With regard to local option, we actually worked with Albemarle County and Charlottesville and our Planning District Commission several years ago to ask the General Assembly to pass a piece of legislation to give us authority for a local option sales tax to help fund the development and expansion of our transit system. That didn't make it out of committee at the time, but I believe based on conversations that there's still support for that concept among the members of the MPO. With regard to the first issue related to devolution, this is something that has generated quite a bit of discussion and concern among our local governments. Charlottesville already has a responsibility for maintenance and operations on their system. Albemarle County does not, and so there's quite a bit of concern at Albemarle County with regard to both the costs and the that would result from devolution, as well as the complexity of the new responsibilities that they would inherit if they took that on. So it is an issue that we've been discussing quite a bit. The PDC has taken a position to oppose devolution, but I think everyone understands the type of conversations that are going on and certainly the limitations in funding that the state faces.
You missed the third question, the governor's plan.
Oh, the governor's plan. We took a position which has been communicated to our General Assembly representatives with regard to the governor's plan, supporting new sources of funding for transportation. At the time, we expressed a preference to keep the gas tax, to increase that, to implement a wholesale sales tax on fuels, and then to develop other specific funding mechanisms to support bike, pedestrian, and transit. And frankly, the ideas that we discussed look quite a bit like those that came out of the Senate. So we're following the discussions that are going on with the conference committee very closely.
Well, thank you for your presentation, sir. Sort of as a follow-up to Mr. Sterling's questions, I'm intrigued by your plea to get us to support local option or regional options or whatever. I have been a voice that questions that as good policy. Certainly the governor has stated a number of times that transportation is a core function, underline the word core function, of state government. And we find ourselves in a position because we decide not to raise the revenue at the state level where it is the responsibility of the state to sort of devolve to a place where the local regions or local entities are asking to do it themselves. I don't see the other than sort of practical frustration, I don't see why that's good public policy if it's a core function of state government. It's sort of where the state just sort of advocates and says, okay, we'll let you do it locally, regionally. Nor do I understand why that's equitable, where regions who are producing the preponderance of GDP for the rest of the state are now also having to do their own capital investment locally that provides funds for the rest of the state to provide resources in this case the roads that they need. So can you help me understand, and you know, and one local option would be put a toll on your bypass, put a toll on somewhere else, put a toll on somewhere here. There's lots of mechanisms to raise funds, and I'm not a proponent of tolls either in general because I don't think they're efficient, nor do I think they're necessarily equitable. But in any case, can you help me understand why it's good public policy, if it's a core function of state government, to not hold the state accountable for doing their job and instead say, give us the local option to do it ourselves? Can you help me understand that?
Well, I'm not sure I can help you understand it. I think we at the MPO have had quite a bit of debate about what the proper public policy is, and certainly the concerns that you mentioned have been voiced at our MPO as part of those debates. I think the reason that we have chosen to support that is really fairly pragmatic, is that we're concerned that if that is left to the state, that sufficient funding mechanisms will not be available. While we think in the Charlottesville-Albemarle metro area that if a local option was available that there would probably be support for funding the right collection of transportation improvements.
Well, let me ask you let me not put words in your mouth, let me ask you this way. If the state was meeting its core responsibility, would you believe your MPO would be advocating that there be a local option to raise money locally for that purpose?
Well, I think that if the state was meeting its full in responsibility in terms of planning for meeting and showing an ability to fund to meet all of the transportation needs going into the future for the different modes, then no, we probably would not. But my understanding of the situation is that our current levels of funding are so far below our long-term need that I guess we don't feel like we have any choice but to advocate for other funding mechanisms.
Sort of to answer everybody, the local funding option was included in the House version of the bill that passed. It was also included in the Senate version of the bill that passed. That was done, I believe, because it was important to Northern Virginia, Hampton Roads, et cetera, for projects in addition to what might be funded because of the extreme needs. It was certainly in Northern Virginia needed in order to get the votes. Right now the conference committee is meeting, and since both sides have that, it will probably most certainly be included in whatever the final bill winds up being. That wasn't really leading to devolution. It was simply for additional projects or additional funding for projects that might not be able to be funded even with the increase that we're looking at in the bill. So just to clarify.
Following on this with taxes and restructuring and that type of thing, there's been discussions over the years about local option sales taxes, that type of thing. As a matter of fact, I believe Fairfax still has the capability of doing that, and they've not implemented it. The problem, though, is that when you do this piecemeal, one region very well may not be helping itself because if they raise the sales tax in their area, then the neighboring counties may find an increase in business. People aren't necessarily patronizing businesses within those regions. Second thing is that you mentioned the bike paths, pedestrian sidewalks, that type of thing in the past. This may sound a little bit odd, but have we done or do we on occasion gauge the number of people using those facilities as we often do with roads? Because I've noticed over time how bike paths and all dramatically increased in cost, and with limited resources in the future, we're going to have to figure out ways of what's priority, how we're going to do it, who's utilizing, how they're utilizing. The other thing is what was troubling a little bit from what I've read about the discussion in the General Assembly is a statement that was made that increases in the sales tax is not fair, and we should be increasing gas tax. Gas tax, as we know, it has problems with diminishing returns. Cars become more efficient. We have electric cars, other transportation, not taxed, or getting any revenues from that regard. And I think it's a point that's being missed. Is someone says, you know, when they make this comment that these people don't benefit from the taxes, from the sales tax, that they're being detrimentally treated. I think they're missing the point that every product in this Commonwealth is delivered to a store that benefits everyone. It's not someone backs out because they didn't use a car. It's like you said, public transportation, bike, or whatever. They have to get to the store, but that product has to get there as well. And I guess my concern is we're not looking at this in a more broad-based, problem-solving way. We're trying to piecemeal it, and I think it's detrimental to our advancement. I mean, have y'all had any discussions
with us on this? Actually, we're working on updating our long-range transportation plan right now. And one of our biggest areas of discussion is how to make the entire system work for everybody in the Charlottesville-Albemarle region. One of the things, getting to your point earlier about data collection, about bike and pedestrian, one of the things that we've done in the last year in the Charlottesville-Albemarle area is a project where a volunteer working with our staff developed a smartphone app that would allow bicyclists to use the GPS function on their smartphone to collect data about where they traveled on their daily basis. And we did a huge data collection using that app in April and May of this past year and developed some great data that our bike and ped folks, as well as their peers at the city and the county, are using to prioritize where the improvements should be put in for bicycle needs in particular. So we're trying to find ways to deal with the needs of the entire system, make the entire system work.
Just a follow-up question to this discussion on the local option. Do you favor the referendum approach, or do you favor that the General Assembly would allow your administrators or your elected officials to just impose the tax?
I really can't speak to the mechanism in particular because that's not something we've discussed at the MPO. I can tell you that I've worked in states that had local option sales tax, and I think in every case, it was based on a referendum.
Just one other. Are you concerned that you'll once you have a revenue source at the local option, then that will be the only source you'll ever see again.
I'm sure there will be people that will be concerned about that, but I think that the revenue streams and the way those are split between the various parts of the system are dictated in the code. And so we would expect, and I'm sure we would advocate for, a continuation of the policies that have been in place here in the state now and in the past.
So no real concern that you'd have an unfunded mandate?
Well, we would...
I'm
sure that if we got to a local option, that that question would be asked fairly strongly of our elected representatives.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick follow-up on that. That's, I guess, the point that I'm trying to make, is we're okay with trying to advocate a local option 1% sales tax. But yet, when we talk 8/10 of a percent on statewide, the collection from tourists and everyone else going through, they have a problem with that because it's detrimental to people with lesser means. Yet it's not detrimental in those same eyes to someone doing a local option. That doesn't make sense.
Look at those. The legislators don't have to make the decision and then worry about being reelected.
But those same legislators are making that point that it's okay for someone to make the decision. That's the point.
Thank you for your presentation. Good job. A question is as much a request as anything. In my mind, transportation is not an end unto itself. It's a means to an end, with the end being economic development or productivity improvements, social justice, land value increases, national defense in some areas. But what we tend to hear in presentations like yours is looking at transportation from the perspective that it is the end.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we need to invest these dollars is to reduce congestion, or for this reason or that reason, all related to the means, but never related to the end. Is it difficult? Does the MTO get into the business of talking about what, in fact, are the ends, and is it possible to share that with this board? Because at the end of the day, these are all return on investment issues in some form or another. And I just think that would be helpful.
And that's exactly the conversation we've been having at the MPO. We've developed a set of goals in our long-range transportation plan process that describe the kind of community that we want to get to and the role that transportation plays in that. We are now discussing a set of performance measures that are primarily measures that will give us a picture of how well various types of transportation improvements will help us move towards that kind of community. And so they really speak to a lot of the things that you mentioned in your question, social equity, access to jobs, environment. I always kind of draw a blank at some point. There are about 16 of them that we're considering. And I would expect that we'll have adopted those and done the math by late summer. And so if you would like, we'd certainly be happy to come back and talk to you more specifically at that time about the goals we have, the performance measures, and how the various options we think are going to impact the community.
I think that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Okay. Thank you very much for your attention and your time.
I'd like to Fredericksburg Area MTO, Skinner and Robbins.
Let's see here. Mr. Chairman, members of the CTP, good morning. My name is Lloyd Robinson, and I'm the administrator for the Fredericksburg Area Metropolitan Planning Organization, FAMPO. And also today, I'll run through this presentation with you pretty quickly. I've handed one out to each of you, and there's some more on the back tables. And then our chair, Mr. Gary Skinner, FAMPO chair, and a member of the Spotsylvania County Board of Supervisors will have some summary remarks, and we'd be happy to, of course, answer any questions you might have. So what I'm providing to you today is the executive summary, if you will, of our 2040 long-range plan, which is now in the public involvement phase. We're looking to adopt this in March. Current situation in our region is that the George Washington region is composed of five municipalities, Stafford County, Spotsylvania County, Caroline County, King George County, and the city of Fredericksburg. The MPO consists of the city of Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania and Stafford counties, although representatives of Caroline and King George, as well as the CTB and Federal Highway Administration and Department of Rail and Public Transit also sit on the MPO Policy Committee as ex officio or non-voting members. It's pretty easy for me to say that transportation issues exist in our region and will worsen in the future unless addressed appropriately. Long-range plan overview. I was before you a few years ago and presented the 2035 plan, which made major changes to how we do transportation planning in our region. This plan addresses the region's future transportation system for all modes. And the plan is composed of two parts, a needs plan, not constrained by revenues, and then a constrained plan, which is restricted to the forecasted revenues. In our region, a regional dialogue is needed, an ongoing regional dialogue is needed to address the constrained plan's financing assumptions, and this plan is a significant policy document for our area. History. Fredericksburg, historically, over the last several decades, has been the fastest-growing region in the state of Virginia and the Commonwealth by a wide margin. You can see the graph at the bottom of this slide. The red line is Fredericksburg, and you can see its growth over the last several decades in comparison to other areas in the Commonwealth as well as the Commonwealth as a whole. Our population today is 327,000 people. That's 2010 census, and that represents a roughly a 400% increase in our population since 1970, 400%. Looking forward, the region is forecasted to grow to about 617,000 persons by 2040. Will remain the fastest growing region in Virginia. Future growth is likely to be low density and largely suburban, with pockets of density identified in local comprehensive plans. Opportunities will increase. Auto orientation will remain. Some people see that as an opportunity, others as a problem. So it's listed both as a challenge as an opportunity. Property values are likely to increase. More jobs will come to the region. Challenges will be more acute. Public transportation choices will be limited, particularly outside of the greater I-95 corridor. Transportation funding challenges will increase, congestion will increase, mobility will decrease, and auto orientation will remain. Land use and transportation, this is new to our plan this year. We undertook in 2009, for a couple of years, we undertook an exercise called land use scenario planning. The purpose of the study was to explore and debate local and regional growth visions, their trade-offs, and their alternative futures. Five scenarios were examined, and we showed the outcomes of those measured in a variety of ways. Going back to Mr. Cole's question about is transportation a means or an end, what are the impacts on land use, quality of life, economic vitality, the environment, et cetera, key questions. The comprehensive plan scenario was used as inputs to the Fayetteville travel demand model to develop the 2040 long-range plan, and there's a simple reason for that is that FAMPO is not in the land use control business. Local governments are. Land use and transportation, the state encourages land use considerations in transportation planning. MAP 21 allows for multiple scenarios to be considered in MPO long-range plans. Land use decisions are and will be controlled by local governments, while FAMPO has developed an advisory scenario plan model that is integrated into its long-range planning process. This modeling capability allows the region and or local governments to explore the implications which different land use patterns and transportation investment strategies have on the region as a whole or individual localities. Example models developed could show potential decreases in highway needs depending on land use policies adopted by local governments. Data models and other tools will continue to be available to local governments for their use in their local planning efforts. So it's a technical assistance measure as well as a visioning effort. 2040 long-range plan. The region faces significant travel demand, increases in travel demand over the next 27 years. Goes without saying. Without improvements, congestion will increase. People's mobility will be reduced. The region's economic competitiveness may decrease and quality of life could suffer. Current funding levels are not forecasted to be sufficient to cover future transportation needs. I don't think that comes as a shock to anyone. The map to the right there shows 2040 congestion levels with no highway improvements. If it is not gray, it's a problem. And you can see the key below shows levels of service ranging from A through F minus. So you can see that's a picture of gridlock is what that is. Regional needs plan is not fiscally constrained, and there were one plan done for each mode, and also we did this for urban and rural both. So we have a unified long-range plan for the entire region. Highway needs, major routes and facilities will struggle to meet travelers' demand. Looking at interchanges on I-95 need work in major corridors such as I-95, US 117, 208, 630, 610, and others. Many bridges will need rehabilitation and a replacement. The needs plan mitigates the majority of highway congestion and other transportation issues, but it carries a significant cost. $12.4 billion is the cost to meet the needs in the needs plan through 2040. Those are inflated numbers, by the way, inflated to the year of construction. This includes $327 million of bicycle and pedestrian needs region-wide. Bicycle and pedestrian needs, closely coordinated with a highway plan, would increase people's non-vehicular mobility and would close gaps in the existing network, which is largely outside of the city of Fredericksburg, non-existent. We don't have a bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure developed in our region. The fulfillment of the needs plan would create a complete system of sidewalks, bikeways, trails, and other facilities. Transit and transportation demand management needs focused on two different markets, the regional market, the George Washington market, you could look at it largely as east-west, and then there's the greater I-95 market. Due to the low densities throughout the region, population densities throughout the region with certain exceptions, although FRED, our regional transit provider, does an extremely good and efficient job, they face a very challenging landscape within which to operate. People don't live close together. I-95, on the other hand, is a highly productive corridor in terms of transit, with some 40% of trips on any given day being taken on some mode of transit. So the needs plan shows increased FRED services in the region, increased commuter services in the greater I-95 corridor, including VRE, express bus, park and ride lot capacity, and transit centers. Current transportation demand management programs will be augmented to stress more van pool and ride sharing. We currently operate 400 van pools in our region, 400 van pools. People's mobility will increase, but outside the I-95 corridor, congestion will not be significantly impacted by transit, even with the needs plan, and that's largely owing to land use. Overall, the needs plan represents a significant expenditure of $1.5 billion. Forecasted needs plan's outcomes, if you recall the first map I showed you that had lots of problems in it, this one has lots less problems. This is not a picture of gridlock, but it carries a price tag. And this is the price tag. The forecasted revenues from all sources in our region between now and 2040 for transportation are about $3.9 billion. The needs are about $13.7 billion, and that leaves a gap of $9.8 billion, which is the red number at the bottom of the bottom of the chart. Constrained highway and bicycle and pedestrian plans. Another thing we do here is we identify the projects based on fiscal constraint and prioritization. Prioritization methodology was adopted by the FAMPL Policy Committee a few years ago, and it ranks projects based on a number of factors. They're listed up there. And we found that approximately $3.3 billion is available for highway projects, including $2.1 billion for the hot lanes, or now called the express lanes. Constrained highway and bicycle plans address congestion and mobility in a limited way. There's considerable investment in transportation regionally. $138.6 million is reserved for smaller scale projects. These include intersection improvements and the like. Fully funded high profile projects in the region include the express lanes that I talked about, the I-95 express lanes, the reconstruction and relocation of the interchange at exit 140, which is in Stafford County, which is Route 630. Replacement of the Falmouth Bridge, a main artery on US 1 across the Rappahannock River. Completion of Fall Hill Avenue improvements, extension of Mary Washington Boulevard, widening of US 17 in Spotsylvania and Stafford counties, and improvements to Onville Road in association with the Marine Corps Base at Quantico and the BRAC actions there. Significant projects for engineering and studies include I-95 Rappahannock River Crossing Project, which Gary will talk about in a moment, improvements in the Jackson Gateway area, I-95 improvements in the Jackson Gateway area of Spotsylvania County, which Gary will talk about, improvements to Lafayette Boulevard and widening of US 1 region-wide. Forecasted outcomes for the constrained highway plan, you can see that it's not as bad as doing nothing, but it's a congested map. It's a congested map, a troublesome map. Transit and TDM outcomes, Virginia Railway Express is already in the process of extension to Spotsylvania County. The station is under construction there, and my understanding is that collaboration with CSX and the other partners continues. FRED, due to financial constraint, FRED services will remain about constant in this plan, flatlined. The projections we were given for state and federal transit funding it showed no increases. So therefore, any increase in FRED service would come through farebox, through local governments, or through some sort of private sector participation. So this plan has FRED keeping pace with inflation is what it does, but no significant expansions. Park and ride lot expansions, consolidation of park and ride lots with expansions to remaining lots. Remember I talked about those 400 van pools and the carpools. 4,000 new parking spaces created. And then transportation demand management improvements, capital assistance for van pools, increased guaranteed ride home program, carpool and van pool incentives, and marketing initiatives. That concludes my presentation. I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Skinner to make his comments, and then again, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank you all for allowing us to speak here today. I appreciate it. Just want to reiterate our priorities on the interchanges. The first one's obviously going to be at exit 140 in Stafford, Route 630. Right now, we're falling short of about $120 million to complete that plan. As he said before, Route 17 and the bridge, the new bridges in the crossing the Rappahannock River with allowing four new CD lanes to go just south of exit 133, which is the Route 3 intersection. And then finally, our other priority would be the Jackson Gateway, exit 126. What we're hoping for is a ramp and reconfiguration of that area, and also to carry CD lanes down to about mile marker 122, which could be a future interchange possibility for us, located next to the HCA hospital, stuff of that nature, and would also give us a new route to the VRE station that we're working on right now, and hopefully, I would say at least within the next year, we'll have trains running out of there. Hopefully, we're restrained by right now having the third rail completed to a certain point, and unfortunately, that point has a 40-foot cliff, and so they have to build walls and stuff like that to explain it. But we're well on our way to the VRE station. The other thing that we'd like to remember is that we always want to keep our eyes on what he called the express lanes now down to exit 126 in the future. And anything that we could do to help Route 1, I think that's for everybody that has Route 1. We can always find a way to help that traffic out too. But once again, I want to thank you very much for allowing us, and Lloyd and I will be happy to answer any questions you have.
Questions?
Yeah, let me rejoin the conversation we had with the last gentleman up there. Thank you for your presentation. We hear presentation after presentation about all the needs and what we're doing. And I understand the pragmatic needs, but what is a little bit concerning to me is, and it's not just germane to you guys, but across the state, we had a governor who was willing to stand up and say he wanted to build a statewide plan, and we've heard little or nothing from a lot of the MPOs about support of that. So my question is, where did you guys stand on that?
Yes, sir. Mr. Lane, FAMPL has taken no position on any mechanisms for how to raise money for transportation. I think that there's, in my view, this not been formal vote, but I think in my view, the FAMPL policy committee members, by and large, believe that there should be more money in the system. There should be.
And Matt, I can add to that too, please. We take no position. The reason was because in the last FAMPO meeting, the members of FAMPO didn't have a chance to speak to their council or their board members to actually come up with solutions. Spotsylvania did. And I can speak for Spotsylvania, if that's all right, is that we don't feel that we feel that those taxes should not go away. And, you know, what we feel is that it's important that you know, the people who use, it's a user fee out there. And if it takes, look for 10 years out, index it to what do we need to bring up the maintenance and the construction we need, and then index it up to that point so that when you can get there, you have the fundings needed. All right? And we just don't feel, and many of our board members felt, that people who don't use the roads are then going to pay for the roads themselves. Sir, I think one of the examples, it was you, sir, I believe, that asked, you know, you get a grocery store, and everybody uses a grocery store, and those trucks bring the groceries to here. But my understanding is when you look at overhead transportation costs, what it actually costs for production of those things, are all put on the price of the can, the commodity. And therefore, when we go in and buy that, we're paying for that situation, and if we add a tax to that, we're almost double indemnity, because we're paying it for the price of the product, which any company has to put in their pricing. And now we buy it, and there's a percent added to that for transportation. So that's where we stand on that one, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Skinner and Mr. Robinson, thank you for your presentation. I'm going to beat on you some more.
Okay.
When I dial 911, does the ambulance fly through the air, or does it travel the road?
Some through the air, sir, and some through the ground, because we do have helicopters.
Anybody that dials 911 wants to hear that I can't get in the ambulance because I didn't pay the user fee for the road. And I absolutely reject the concept that everybody in the Commonwealth does not get a benefit from the transportation system. So I reject that as a concept. I don't use the public schools in the state, so why should I pay for them? Why don't you just let the people who go to the public schools pay for them? It's a core function of state government. It always has been, and until we change that, we shouldn't deviate from the fact that it's our responsibility as a state to fund it. My question is, every board of supervisors chairman and every mayor and every chamber of commerce from Northern Virginia down through your area, down through Richmond, down through Hampton Roads, signed a letter six, 8 weeks ago that they sent to the governor and others that said the solution to about five tenets in the letter, which is fund the core function, and the solution should be statewide. That included the areas that y'all are talking about. So every chairman of a board and every mayor of a city and every executive director or CEO of the chambers that your organization, that your area includes, signed that letter. So y'all come to us and we say, we need $9 billion through 2040. Northern Virginia could eat that tomorrow. So could Hampton Roads. There's huge issues that face us. And on one hand, the elected officials and the business community have said, statewide, fund the program. And yet, the organization made up of those same, some of those same individuals, in your case, the Fredericksburg Area Metropolitan Organization, doesn't take a position either on that nor on which plan out there is the better plan. So I think it's incumbent on all of us as citizens or elected officials or appointed officials or representatives to try to be consistent with our voice and try to come to some agreement with what the solution is. But I hear one thing from your elected bodies and your chambers, and I hear another thing from your MPO, and that concerns me.
Sir, and sir, you're right. I mean, the only reason that this FAMPO did not put a position out there was because when we had our meeting, all right, none of the other localities really had met with their council members or their other board members to come up with a resolution. We were fortunate at Spotsylvania. We did, and we sent our letter out. I don't think it's a neglect on FAMPOs. We could have probably done it better. We probably could have managed it better, get out there and make sure that the other localities were doing this prior to our meeting, but we didn't, sir. And that's the only reason we're not doing that, sir.
My point is not to criticize. My point is just to point out and to shine some light on the fact that FAMPOs or MPOs or TPOs, elected bodies, all have unique responsibilities. And your colleagues from the Charlottesville area just said, give me a local option. The Golden Crescent said, don't give me a local option, at least in the category, the group that I'm talking about, said it needs to be statewide. And we're all singing different tunes, but we're not, you know, I did read, I think the conference committee has resolved their differences. I don't know what the answer is, but they resolved the differences recently. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. But it bothers me from a public policy, and I don't have to be practical when I'm sitting here talking about this. I can be philosophical. I don't have to get the votes in the General Assembly. I don't have to cobble that together. I understand that. But it bothers me that we are neglecting and going away from the core function of state government and devolving, not in the sense necessarily of coordinated, but devolving, where localities, where we're balkanizing the state, and the people that are generating the GDP for the state now have to do their own capital investment, and they share the return. So others are the states that don't put the capital in, but they get the return. How is that equitable? How is that following the philosophy of this being a core function of state government? And why in God's name, other than we just got so frustrated with our legislative process both federally and at the state level, how is that good public policy? I just want somebody to take me outside and give me an hour to explain it.
Okay,
those guys aren't big enough to do it.
Mr. Skinner, I just wanted to respond to the comments you made about paying more for the product as a result of sales tax. But what you fail to understand there is that if you raise the gas tax, the price is going to go up, as you said, in the body of the product. People are going to pay either way for it. It's the most efficient way and the best way to get it on a comprehensive basis. Mm-hmm. That is wise. And I think that's the point we sometimes do. It's, well, let's just raise the gas tax. That's okay. It affects the poor just as much, if not more so, because of transportation aspect plus the food and the products, the genes and everything else that can procure it. It's been that price. It doesn't just go away because you're giving it to a different source. So, I mean, I think we need to keep that in mind. The other thing is that when you come together and bring a book like this, it's very informative. But the amount you're asking for is something that, at this point in time, I don't think you have anyone the ability to bring that together, not for one region. And I think it's much more productive to bring these in a way to have a priority system, a price to that, what is most important for your area, not a conglomerate of $327 million bike pass and that type of thing. Is that your priority? I guess that's where I'm going with, because I think when you come in and say that we need to do this, you're not ready as seatmate mentioned to support a particular program to raise the funds, but yet you're bringing these dollars here to us. Just something to keep in mind. I think it would be more beneficial if we had it prioritized with the dollars associated with the project so it's most important for the region.
Mr. Chairman,
can we respond to that for a second?
Yes.
Mr. Lauterbach, thank you for that comment. I probably did a poor job of running through this. My intent coming here was not to say, please give us $10 billion. I mean, that'd be a fool's error. Right? What we're showing is the relative magnitude of the problem. That's what we're showing. Our story is pretty simple. We have a very high growth rate historically. That will continue. We have a very dispersed method of settling, developing our lands, which is expensive. And we have congested roadways and bridges that are in disrepair, as well as transit needs and bicycle and pedestrian, et cetera. Okay. I mean, all of that is widely recognized. All right? We play by the rules, and we forecasted the revenues under the state and federal guidelines for doing that. And we said, okay, that's how much money we have now. What should get funded? And we have a prioritization system to do that. We also prioritize the projects in the needs plan. Right? So if someone wanted a list of our prioritized projects, we'd be happy to deliver that. But I think what the message I'm trying to deliver and what I'm delivering in our public outreach efforts for this plan is to highlight the magnitude of the issue that confronts us and some of the underpinnings to that, not the least of which is land use. Land use policy decisions cost money from a transportation standpoint. Just one other thing. Back, I think it was 2010, we worked with the General Assembly, and we did create the George Washington Region Toll Road Authority. It currently lacks a project, but we have a toll road authority which has the capability to develop toll facilities in our region, as well as to own and operate transit systems. Okay, so that's out there. So the region has, I guess, come together and try to take action to help ourselves. And I think part of that was to send a message to the state saying, we're willing to help ourselves, so could we get a little more from you?
I thank Mr. Cole, then Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Skinner, and Mr. Robinson, for being here. Just to opine a little bit on some of the comments that have been made, I think we can get ourselves tangled up in the philosophical discussion over what's the right way to fund transportation. We do. I think the governor's been pretty clear throughout that whatever transportation plan we look at has to accomplish three criteria. It has to solve the revenue problem or the lack of revenue problem that we have. It has to have long-term sustainability, and it has to garner 51% of the votes. And while all of us can come up with 100 solutions to the first two, I'm not sure that those great solutions of whether they're local taxes or increasing gas tax and putting wholesale taxes, I'm not sure that they would ever come close to accomplishing the third criteria. And I say that only from a standpoint of, I think as we move forward trying to find a new revenue formula that works, it's best to keep that in mind, that, you know, it isn't just about the first two pieces of the puzzle, it is about that third piece. And, most of us can sit here and come up with plans that that would solve all of the problems, except at the end of the day, none of us have a vote. And there are some guys up the street that have a vote, and we've got to figure out a way to get 51%. So I share that only for perspective.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know the agenda is long, and we have another presentation coming from another MPO, which is a little bit of an aberration from the ones we've heard from, but I think the comments today are all born out of frustration of this board. We know what the message that we delivered is, and the cards are being dealt up the street, and that's the hand we're going to be dealt by whatever comes out of the grinder. And from that point, I think, as Roger said, it's going to be our job, from whatever we get revenue-wise, to make sure that this board prioritizes how we spend that money, and the MPOs get the message that it's got to be prioritized. That's the only way we're going to look at things. And I mean, that's the bottom line here. So just remember that. Okay?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just a brief, to Mr. Garzinski's point, I live in the Hampton Roads area, although I represent specifically represent urban areas, which can include Fredericksburg and others. In today's Virginia pilot down in Norfolk, they were talking about the effects of sequestration, and particularly on our state and our region, and they are dramatic. I mean, I'm talking aircraft carriers sitting unrepaired. I'm talking about squadrons being stood down. I'm talking about people in the military being laid off. Civilian contractors being decimated, and this is because our legislature and our president can't get their act together and do what needs to be done. If we don't need those things, we ought to get rid of them. If we need them, we ought to maintain them and have them ready. As we look at prioritization, I'm all about bike paths, but I'm less about them when I don't have the money, unless they are providing true transportation as opposed to quality of life. I'm less interested in landscaping. I'm less interested in all those things that go to quality of life as opposed to getting from point A to point B. Certainly in the eastern countries in our world, bicycles are a primary mode of transportation. And I'm all for encouraging that. But when we get down to we have no money, do we put money, in your view, would your budget include what I would call recreational / quality of life things, which are not primary to getting from point A to point B? Or would you exclude those? What would you do? Because as I look at your budget, it's sort of hard to pull that out. And as I've said here, we looked at a bike path that was 99%, a walking path, which was 99% recreational, quality of life in the city of Norfolk. We looked at one along Route 5, I recall, Mr. Garzinski, a couple years ago, and it was like $1 million a mile to do a bike path that was purely recreational. I mean, people weren't riding to work, they weren't riding to the hospital, they weren't going to the library. They were out riding, enjoying the scenery, which is a great thing. But when we get down, there was no money. Those things go way out of your budget?
Sir, let me answer that. That's a good question. I think one of the things you're asking for is us to give you a priority of what we would like, if there's a list of things. And we've done that, I think, when we talked about exit 140 and then moving up to Route 17, exit 133, and down to Jackson Gateway. And that's really based on transportation issues. We just do not have the capability to put cars on there in the near future. And as far as the pathways, the trailways, we have an organization called Spotsylvania Greenway Initiative. And so far, they're the ones that have been doing all the work. Mm-hmm. We do look for maybe some enhancement funds, but a lot of that is borne by the supervising board in Spotsylvania to do that. And the only reason we brought that up, too, is because obviously Spotsylvania has a lot of the Civil War area down, and we get a lot of, and we've done studies on that to find that more people will come visit, and our intent is to link each war paddle area so that people can actually take bikes and walks, and that will bring in more tourism. So it is an economic thing. I do not think if you ask us today what our priorities, we would give you what we have, what we've done as a FAMPO. And the bottom line comes to this. It really is. It's you and I, we don't make the decisions. It's the people up the road, like you said, that's going to make those decisions. We're going to live with it, and we're going to make it happen. And whether or not, you know, whatever the governor comes out and whatever you do, we're going to have so much money, and it's going to be back on us to do that. Now, one of the great things that we have right now is the VRE. Since Spotsylvania has joined VRE, it's a tremendous amount of money that we receive each year, which does not come out of our general fund. So as far as that goes, a lot of our transportation issues are with the VRE, whatever we get, and we've done a lot with that too, sir. So I don't want to think that the trailways is a big issue. It's not, sir. We're going to make it happen because we think it's important. If there's help out there, we'd be obligated to ask for it. But if it's a primary, what your priorities are, we certainly have stated that, and we'd be more than happy to send that in writing to you all. But I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right, let me
I've been on record saying the only way not fund transportation is not funded, so I'm not as philosophical as a lot of my other people here. But I would say this, we're all looking for action, and whether it's your TPO or ours or any one across the state, just sitting on the fence and not taking a position is not going to get it done. So I would ask in the future that when there are plans out there, you know, it's easy to say, well, we're not taking a position, and then turn back and say, complain about everything. I don't think that's going to get it done. So I would just encourage you in the future, just like I would the others, to take a position and get behind something. So,
and sir, I will tell you, we failed to do that. You're absolutely right. We learned about it, and we didn't take the proper action until we met the next meeting, and we should have gone through all the boards and said, look, let's have an answer when we met. We did not do that, and we apologize. I don't think FAMPA was trying to get out of a decision. And it was just poor planning, sir, on our part.
Let Mr. Sterling wrap up. Last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, since this is my MPO, I can't let the conversation conclude without speaking to it. And Gary, I understand your frustration, but I hope you understand ours as well.
Absolutely.
We're looking at a situation where we don't have the revenues in the future. Now, we've gone through several MPOs already. We'll have more. Each of them have their list of the things that they want. We can't fund all those. And when we can't fund them, whether it's maintenance, and we saw an episode that's popped up down in Hampton Roads recently, construction, it's always finger pointing at the state by MPOs, by localities saying, well, that's VDOT's problem. VDOT needs to do more. CTB needs to do more. The governor needs to do more. I think my colleagues that have expressed, you know, taking no position is not helpful because we do need to have positions taken, but we also need positive positions taken. Most of the positions we see taken oftentimes, although there was some that talked about a local option, are negative. The governor puts out a plan. First, he puts out a plan on putting a toll on 95. And all kinds of opposition comes out from it, not just down there, but up in our area. Can't put a toll on it. But you had said the people that use the road should pay the freight. Pardon the phrase, but I mean, they should be paying the cost of using it. You don't get much more direct cost than that. Now, you talked about, I guess, your position or the position of your board was that the fuel tax should be increased because you think that is directly related to the roads and therefore that's the appropriate way rather than sales tax. But I think far too many people forget that the gas tax isn't just funding the roads. It's being, whether you want to call it allocated, diverted, set aside, whatever phrase you want to use, money for our transit systems, whether it's Metro up in Northern Virginia or around the state various transit systems. VRE that you talked about, you and I both know that VRE gets tax gas revenue. They're not on the roads, but the riders of it, the users of it, they benefit from that gas tax. The challenge is you've got a road system which is trying to fund essentially all our transportation requirements, whether they're the pedestrian, the bike pass, the metro, the trains. It's trying to fund all of these different transportation nodes throughout the Commonwealth. It's a declining revenue stream as cars get more fuel efficient as we go to electric cars. essentially, you know, one day, if we're all blessed with whatever everybody wants and zero emissions and nobody's using carbon fuel, it's all electric vehicles, who's going to fund any of this? Our whole transportation system will come to a halt because there won't be any money, not just to not fund the roads, whether it's construction or maintenance, but also rail, transit, buses, all of those things. The money just dries up. It disappears. We have to have a new paradigm here where we're looking at transportation funding and what is a sustainable long-term path, not a let's patch it for 5 years with a certain indexing or a little bit of an increase on the gas tax, but it's what is going to be a revenue stream that will be here when my children, my grandchildren are on the roads to fix those roads, to maintain those roads, to fund all these other users that aren't paying the gas tax, but they are benefiting from the transportation system. So I'm hopeful, and this goes for any of the other MPOs that are in the room, our MPO, MPOs that aren't in the room, localities that aren't in the room, is we have to understand, as local officials, which you and I are, we can't point fingers at Richmond and say it's your fault that the roads aren't fixed if at the same time we're opposing any proposal that comes out and not putting forward a positive proposal of our own. I don't know what that proposal is, and there's going to be a great deal of disagreement, a great deal of debate, I would imagine, amongst all localities. But if we're going to be local leaders, if we're going to be regional leaders, if we're going to support fixing the system, we have to be in there helping to support it, not just shooting holes at whatever the governor puts forward or somebody else puts forward. So please understand, I understand your frustration, and as far as the project, love all the projects, we don't have the money for them, and we've had that discussion. But we've got to come up with some way going forward, because the transportation debate in the Commonwealth of Virginia is all about somebody makes a proposal, somebody takes a leadership position, and then everybody rounds up to start shooting at it. And therefore, nothing happens. We got to get past that. So,
okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to let that be the last question. Mr. Skinner and Mr. Robson, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for putting up with this stuff.
Oh, thank you.
You've
got more to put up with.
Eric Randall.
All right. Good morning, members of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. My name is Eric Randall. I'm a transportation engineer with the Council of Governments in Metropolitan Washington, which is the staffing organization for the National Capital Region Transportation Planning Board. And again, that's the MPO for the Washington, D.C. area. The TPB actually meets on the third Wednesday of every month at noon, so I just want to extend greetings from the chairman of the board this year, which is Scott York of Loudoun County Board of Supervisors, and from my transportation director, Ron Kirby, Director of Transportation Planning at COG. All right, let's try that. So, National Capital Region, federally designated MPO for the Washington, D.C. region. We have approximately 30 jurisdictions and other agencies that are represented on the board, plus ex officio members from federal and other agencies. Transportation Planning Board area as a whole is approximately 5 million people, has over 2 million Virginians. Approximately 28% of the population of Virginia lives in the TPB area. When we look at the planning area, we look at inner core, outer core, and suburban jurisdictions, and those are designated by the shading on the map, and I'll refer back to those further in the presentation. We also include the counties stretching beyond, such as Fredericksburg, in our modeling analysis for transportation. So I'm going to talk to you about two issues. One is our financially constrained long-range plan, so I'm just going to focus on what's already plan to be funded in the area, and then I'll talk about MAP 21 and how it's going to affect us in the Washington, D.C. region. So again, we carry out the constrained long-range plan as part of the federally required planning process, and our current out year is through 2040. So through 2040, our population is going to grow from over 5 million to nearly 6.5 million, and particularly Loudoun County and Prince William counties are expected to see approximately a 40% growth in population. Employment growth will also increase even more, hopefully. And again, Loudoun and Prince William counties are expected to see almost an 80% growth in employment. So travel is going to go up, 24% population, 36% employment. More people will be driving, more people will be taking transit, there'll be more truck trips. It's important to note that VMT per capita, vehicle miles traveled per capita, only increases by 1%. So while there's a lot more people on the roads, they're not necessarily traveling further, there's just more of them. Currently, the constrained long-range plan only funds a capacity increase of 7% in lane miles. So when you add all the truck trip growth on top of that small percentage of lane miles, you get a 78% increase expected in congestion in the AM rush hour. So we're going to have a lot of rush hour jams. This is the commute travel by mode and mode share. Commute travel makes up about 21% of all trips throughout the week, if you will, but is the greatest intensity of demand on the system. Auto drivers will go up transit proportionate to the increase in overall trips, but HOV and carpools are expected to go up by 61%. This is because we have the express lanes already operating on the Capitol Beltway, and the express lanes are going to be opened on I-95 here in just a few years. We're also seeing a tremendous predicted growth in non-motorized travel, bike and walk, because as we increase density of development, we expect more people to take advantage of non-motorized means to get around. So this is the commute travel by looking at the regional core, by the inner suburbs, and by the outer suburbs. In the regional core, we're looking at Alexander and Arlington, and you can see that during the AM rush, over 50% of people are traveling by transit, so that's a very critical mode for us as we look at transportation. Inner suburbs, people travel about roughly proportional to cars as overall demand, but again, transit is very significant, and you can see the growth in HOV carpool there. But particularly the outer suburbs, when we get out to Loudoun or Prince William County, we're expecting to see a small reduction in proportion of single-occupant vehicles and a much greater increase in carpools and in transit riders with those improvements we talked about, the express lanes, increased rail service up and down the I-95 corridor. So here's highway congestion. It's a little hard to see in this graph, but essentially highway congestion gets much worse, particularly on sections of I-66, I-95 further south where it isn't right now. However, congestion is not expected to be that bad on the Capitol Beltway where we have the express lanes to provide a free flow method of travel. And also I-66 inside the Beltway we're expecting will be HOV3+, and that also should limit congestion on that vital corridor in the area. Here's transit congestion on the Metrorail system. Metrorail carries about 730,000 people per day. Another 700,000 people ride a commuter rail and bus systems in the area. And by 2040, at the current funded capacity of Metrorail, we're expecting many of the lines to be highly congested on the cars, and that's a key issue for us in this region. If we could only have the cars, this is the same rail network, but if we could just go from 6-car trains to 8-car trains, you know, making more effective use of that rail capacity, we could limit that congestion on the transit system. Air quality, one of our primary goals as an MPO is tracking air quality. Technological improvements are expected to dramatically improve air quality through about 2030. After that, we're expecting to sort of plateau when it comes to the technology. We then have increased miles of travel, which then drives up air quality emissions slightly after 2030. So here's the bottom line in terms of funding. This is, again, what's in the constrained long-range plan already, just under $223 billion between 2011 and 2040. Majority of that actually goes to transit because of the operations and maintenance of Metrorail and the other transit systems. Only about 7% of this funding is expected to go to new capacity. The other 93% is state of good repair, current operations. So the issues highlighted in the 2012 Constrained Long-Range Plan is that we're looking at Metrorail repair needs. We currently have the PREA funding where the federal government matches $150 million a year with $50 million each from D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, but that will expire in 2020. Roadway congestion, we continually rank number one or near number one across the nation in terms of traffic congestion. So figuring out better ways of moving people around is critical in our region. Again, I talked about transit congestion already, but the goal of the TPP is to look at ways to improve the existing capacity of the system, alleviate bottlenecks, make maximum use of the infrastructure that's already in place. And then we've already had several mentions of how critical land use is in transportation, but if we can concentrate development around transit, around the most effective parts of the current system, we can really continue to improve mobility and livability for all people. So we have a request also for additional funding. What's going to happen for a state of good repair for Metrorail goes beyond 2020, whether there's any funding to expand Metrorail capacity through 8-car trains and the necessary infrastructure for them. Roadway funding, again, we want to fund, especially looking at specific bottlenecks in the system and how to correct those bottlenecks, but maintain state of good repair for highways and bridges. And within the Council of Governments, we also have the planning directors that come together, improving the coordination of land use, balancing travel demand across the region in order to maximize the effectiveness and the efficiency of the current system is critical. In the region, we do have several recent projects, the express lanes on the Beltway, the intercounty connector, which is up in Maryland, connecting Montgomery and Prince George's County, and the currently under construction rail to Dulles. All these are being funded by direct beneficiaries, primarily through road tolls. So we're already experiencing this in this region. We see this as one potential option for the future to fund some of our needs. In addition, the TPB comes together and funds regional programs that stretch across the three states, if you will, of Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. We have our MATOC, Transit Operations Coordination Program, which facilitates coordination between the operation centers of District DOT, Maryland DOT, Virginia DOT, so that communications and information is passed across the region to customers, to incident response folks. We have Commuter Connections, which funds things like teleworking, van pools, carpools, guaranteed ride home. Again, so much of that is interjurisdictional, interregional, and so we have a regional campaign to fund those sort of programs. And then we have a Street Smart campaign, which talks about pedestrian, bicyclist, and automobile safety, again, across the region. We also applied for a USDOT Tiger grant and got a project to implement priority bus projects across the region. We see bus priority treatments in terms of transit signal priority, dedicated lanes, improved facilities for buses key to maximizing the transit system, particularly in the near term. It's one of the most cost-effective measures we can undertake in improving overall transportation capacity. So there's the changing federal context. There's already been quite a mention of MAP 21. We're already, 20% of the way through MAP 21, so it'll be interesting to see what the future brings at the federal level as well. But the things we're looking at are the performance-based planning and programming goals that are required under MAP 21, PBPP, which we call it BIME. And again, USDOT is required to establish these goals, and then these goals will also flow down to the state DOTs, MPOs, and transit operators to prove their performance against the federally required goals. And so PBPP means that we have to set targets against these national goals. We're going to have to do that as a conversation among the transit operators and among the state DOTs in our region. And so we're going to concentrate on those target areas that require multi-agency attention, such as safety, congestion reduction, system reliability, and air quality. We also have other new responsibilities in terms of programs under MAP 21. The FTA has restructured its 5310 Enhanced Mobility Program to provide transportation alternatives for seniors and individuals with disabilities. And so we're currently in discussions with DRPT and other agencies discussing how that responsibility will be carried out in the Washington, D.C. area. The Transportation Alternatives Program combines previous safety loop programs, focusing on things like recreational trails, safe routes to school, and we're currently coordinating with VDOT and the other DOTs on how we can bring that program together under one schedule, one administration system, one coordination process for the region as a whole, so that we can look at regional projects as well as projects that take place within specific jurisdictions or locations. So the TPB is working to address the many transportation challenges we have in the National Capital Region. We were recently ranked number one again by the Texas Transportation Institute for traffic congestion. So we also are looking for additional funding to maintain and expand the region's transportation system. And naturally, the jurisdictions and members of the Transportation Board look forward to working with the Commonwealth Transportation Board to find solutions to these challenges. So that concludes my presentation. Based on the earlier conversations, I think some of it is above my pay grade, but I will mention that the Transportation Planning Board did approve a letter that went to the legislatures of Maryland and Virginia and to the D.C. Council in December that expressed their interest in additional transportation funding and proposed that there be local options for funding in the region. Even within our region, we have significant differences of opinion in how to fund transit versus highway improvements versus pedestrian and bike improvements. And there's no one solution that fits all, we feel, and therefore having maximum flexibility at the local level, at the regional level, and again, even at the state level is critical to funding our transportation needs in the region. So that concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much. Questions?
All I would enlighten my board on this particular MPO, this is unique unto all the others because of the jurisdictions involved. The numbers are almost beyond imagination when you talk about growth. As Eric talked about, the metro system every day in the paper for the past 3 years, front page of the Post has been another failure in the system because it's now 25 years old. Or what is it?
It was opened in 76, so it's coming up on 4 years.
Almost 35, yeah. So the local option is something that may be important because of the magnitude of the challenge. We are not number one in employment in Metro Washington. We are not number one in population in Metro Washington, but we continue to be number one in traffic congestion. So bear that in mind when the dollars are to be dealt, especially with Metro and things that Thelma's doing with VRE, and when sometime in mid-July we come back to this board on our north-south corridor that Doug and I worked on, which hopefully alleviates some traffic as well. But that's kind of my take as the Northern Virginia rep, and I don't know if Fran wants to add anything to that, but it's just unto itself as an MPO because of where we are.
No, I'll just agree with you. There's nothing really to add.
All right.
$0.235. It hasn't been raised since approximately the same time as the federal gas tax, so 92, 93. It's a little bit higher than Virginia. It's either 22.5 or 23.5. That's what's in my mind right now.
And we continue to have dialogue with Maryland on bridge crossings. We've done the hot lanes, but when you get to the Potomac River, the hot lanes end. Those are the kind of challenges that we have. And then the district is unto itself as well.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, sir.
What I'd like to do is the board's pleasure, maybe if you agree, maybe defer the general assembly update to maybe when the secretary gets back, and then we'll call Joanne up, and if we just could move into the financial report, so that would be okay.
I was just
so why don't we do the financial report?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I think this month, given the later date of the board meeting, I was able to get the presentation out to you in advance, and hopefully you've all had an opportunity to look at it. If it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman and members, I'll just hit the conclusion really fast, and then if there's any particular questions, then I can address them. Get to that conclusion really quick. In terms of revenues, in terms of our transportation revenues, just want to point out that revenues are continuing to be collected at about just above the forecast of about 3%. In terms of spending, just generally speaking, we are pretty much where we thought we would be this time of the year. Our spending is continuing to to track it just at about where we would expect it. In terms of air construction spending, it continues to be a little higher than last year, largely related to the increased activity on the new PPTA projects. And in terms of maintenance activity, we're about where we thought we would be, and continuing on course to the having a small allocation balance this year of something under $50 million.
Just, Mr. Lawson, I know you mentioned that the revenues were roughly the same, but in the shuts that, for us, the state revenues are sort of increasing, and the gas tax is actually down, even though it's about where we thought it would be in your budget. But it just shows that we are, that is a declining source of revenues for us.
I would concur with your statements.
Because we saw general sales activity pick up, yeah, mm-hmm. Gasoline, the money we were getting from the state sales tax, or gas tax, decreased in the month, particularly in January. So I know it's gas taxes and all that, but it just highlights really the issue we're dealing with when relying solely on that source.
Agreed.
Any other questions? All right, thank you, Mr. Lawson. Take the next item.
Okay, this presentation is a, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, is a follow-up from the preliminary update I gave you last month. It indicated I would come back with some more details around the preliminary outlook for, or the financial plan for 2014 through 2019. In terms of this, of the plan, it is a total of about $25.6 billion over the six-year period. That is a reduction of about $1.2 billion when you compare 6 years year over year. The reductions in that are kind of spread across different places. And again, as we're looking at a rolling 6 years, so you know, year 13 drops off, year 19 adds on. So it's a rolling plan. State revenues over this period is up about $234 million. Federal revenues is where we really took a big hit. In terms of reductions, we're some $720 million down. That is, I'll talk about that earlier, a little later, but that's largely related to MAP 21 and how we estimate those revenues. The bond proceeds that are expected in the program are down by some $500 million. And again, I said that's expected, and that's not totally revenue driven. And then there are other revenue sources, miscellaneous sources, local funds, et cetera, that are account for about $240 million. State revenues, just our source of the revenue forecast, is based on the December 2012 forecast from the Department of Taxation. The federal revenue forecast, as I mentioned last month, we do estimate here at VDOT. We base it off of the most recent and available tables that we have from Federal Highway Administration, based on what we have seen since the expiration of Safety Lou, basically the flat holding of the federal revenue, we have not predicted any growth in the federal revenues beyond MAP 21 in 2014. So there's a flat-lined revenue approach there. We felt that was important given the environment. In terms of bonds, as I mentioned, we are continuing an air bond program largely laid out in the Governor's 2011 Transportation Funding Bill. The final or the third series of the $600 million in CPR sales will be done in May or June, so we'll have reached the $1.8 billion that we were after. Given though that we have seeing a significant reduction in insurance premium revenues, we don't look like we'll be able to sell any additional CPR bonds until 2016. As a result of this federal revenue, the PTF insurance premium reductions, there will be about $300 million less CPR bonds issued over the period, and that will have impacts both to highways and as well as rail and transit activities. The Garveys, Unlike the CTR bonds, the Garveys are very specific to just a small handful of projects. Currently, the plan has about $869 million in Garveys to be issued over the period, and those bonds are intended to support Route 460 and the Coalfields Expressway should it move forward. Again, the issuance schedule for the bonds in the Garveys are purely driven based on project readiness, and so they could alter a little bit from what's in the plan. When we, in 2011, when the bond package was put into place and we talked about the Garveys, we'd indicated that the debt service on the Garveys would be around 10% of the federal revenues, and that's where we appear to be at this point, given the planned bond that will be issued during the next 6 years. This chart just gives you an illustration of all of the major revenues totaling the $25.6 billion, and you can see the comparison to the existing 2013 through 2018 plan. Just kind of point out to Mr. Lane's point, when you look at the HMOF revenues, they only grow by about 0.6% over the period, and the main revenue source for the HMO is the gas tax. The trust fund revenues do grow by about 4%, again, largely driven by the sales and tax. And you can see that the federal revenues are held constant from 15 out. This is a graphic, gives you an illustration of the orders of magnitude of each of the revenue sources. You can see clearly the federal revenue is their largest single source, followed by motor fuels, motor vehicle sales, and then the retail sales tax. The needs of the HMO do continue to outpace the revenues of the fund. To support the needs of the fund, we will have to continue crossover. And you can see that in this plan, we are anticipating crossover amounts in 14 of $433 million, growing to about $524 million in 2019.
Is that, if we were to look at that same slide the last time you briefed it, is it more or is it less? In other words, is the crossover amounts declining versus what our projections were going up?
They are fairly consistent with where we thought they would be.
Of course, this doesn't include if there were additional revenue.
Correct. This is purely based on
where we are
today and what we know today.
Ms. Walton.
I'm confused. When you led us through slide two, which talked about the state revenues being up by 234 and the federal revenues down by 7.6, I believe it's a $500 million difference. And of course, the bond proceeds are sort of a one-time deal that don't necessarily affect crossover the same way.
Correct.
So if I take 234 up and 726 down and other revenue down at 244, I'm down a billion and up 230 on that slide. So it's $800 million difference. So why wouldn't that affect crossover? Why wouldn't the crossover numbers be higher?
The crossover numbers, again, are driven based off of your state revenues. State revenues, and I showed you on the HMO, does have about a $54 million growth over the six-year period. So that is, the HMO revenue is really what's supporting the need for crossover. Mm-hmm. This chart gives a kind of a high-level view of the funding available by major, or the planned allocations by major category. You can see the amounts by category, and then I've shown the comparison to the prior six-year financial plan. And as you can see, for the most part, every category is reduced some as it relates to the reduction, the exception of maintenance. we continue to fund the maintenance program based on the perceived needs of that program. And as has been the case since 2010, there is no funding in construction to go through the allocation formula. This just gives you a graphic of kind of a comparison, an illustration of where the spending is by program, and you can see maintenance and operation consumes just shy of 50% of the budget, and the remainder is spread across about a quarter to construction and the remaining quarter to all the other programs. I do want to conclude by just re-emphasizing the fact that this preliminary 6-year financial plan is based on current law and the current revenues that we have today. We don't know what will come out of the General Assembly, but if we are successful in having a new transportation program and new transportation funding, obviously this will be revised, and I will provide you with those impacts.
Yes, Miller.
Question on slide 9, which is the maintenance and operations that go up $274 million during the period. Is that because of changes in cost for the same units of work, or is that because there's more work because we haven't done enough work along the way? Is it volume? Is it unit? Or is it
current demand? The growth in prior to last year, we were doing a fixed 4% growth in the maintenance program. Last year, we revisited that, and what we decided to do was to grow the maintenance program based on the producer price index. So it's growing over the period at something between 2.5% and 3% based on PPI.
I have a concern that we're careful when we project maintenance fees. Careful in the fact that we be very realistic. And obviously some of the recent problems we've had in the Hampton Roads District might lead one to believe that there was some serious pent-up demand as it relates to maintenance. And so as we're funding maintenance, sort of going along here, fat and happy, saying we're funding maintenance first, according to the law. It's a question of how we denote what maintenance, how we quantify them if not a maintenance is out there. And I'm concerned, and I don't know this, I'm just expressing my concern, that we're underestimating the true maintenance, and we're deferring maintenance that's going to come back to haunt us, and we're going to get smacked upside the head by this deferred maintenance that we haven't recognized along the way, where if we were prudent, we would recognize it, whether it was funded or whether it wasn't, and say, this is the maintenance that needs to be done today. And I think our recent situation in Hampton Roads makes me more concerned about that. So I'm not sure you're the person to answer the question or not, but I would certainly like us to take some time to talk about how we really quantify what the maintenance needed is, and ensure that we're accurate as we can be, so that we don't have a situation where we spend $1 for 10 years and in year 10 we got to spend $100. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't amortize that, we didn't do the things we should have done along the way, and the small leak in the roof becomes not just the roof anymore, it's the floor of the second story that's got to be replaced. So I don't know how all that really works for the districts on up, but that's certainly a concern I have, and I want to be, I want us to be honest and diligent and to recognize, make sure we recognize exactly what our maintenance needs are. Even if the General Assembly decided not to fund them, we still need to know exactly right. What they are.
Ms. Lena, Ms. Sterling was next.
Okay. He's on his iPad.
My point is that, just, well, we've had that. We're not funding maintenance. I mean, the general answer to the question is we're not. And then so the second part of that is the work that we're doing, is it beneficial? Is it doing the right thing? So we've had reports over the last couple of years in detail that we are not doing the amount of maintenance we need to do. And part of that is a result of, I'm sure, dealing with not enough monies. Part of it's an execution, and I understand where you're coming from, Mr. Miller, and I think that's something that we all need to come to grips with, is are there other potential areas where things are not being done because we simply don't have the monies to do it. But that may be a different issue than execution of a particular contract in that regard. So I think there's a combination of things going on. This, you know, Mr. Lott pointed out, but I'm pretty comfortable we're not funding maintenance the way we should. I mean, that'd be my overall perspective. As a state,
not a particular issue, but as a state,
look at the condition of the roads. We've got condition reports showing us we're not meeting the standards we set for ourselves. And so we made these decisions between crossover or federal capital, and I think your point's dead on, Mr. Miller.
Other comments? Thank you, Mr. Lawson. Go on to Ms. Busher now.
Good morning. This is what we normally call the kickoff of the update of the six-year improvement program for 2014 through 2019. Again, as Mr. Lawson spoke earlier, we're obviously presenting to you before we know where the General Assembly may land with a new legislation for transportation. But we'll give you the picture of where we are currently. The first two slides in the presentation is just a review of where we've been over the last three updates. As you can see, 2012 through 2017 picked up a good portion of the bonds that were authorized in the governor's last transportation package. And as those bonds fall off in terms of the rolling 6 years, that does impact the total that we'll show you. I'll show you in just a minute related to the forecast of 2014 through 19. The second slide is just a breakdown by the actual highway system. The 2013 through 2018 compare to the planned at this point, 2014 through 2019, shows a difference of $1.3 billion. Now, the difference is related to several large factors, which is the dropping off of 2013 and the adding of 2019. Now, that results in less CPR bonds in this six-year window as compared to the previous six-year window. As John indicated, we're selling the last $600 million in this year from that $1.8 billion authorization. And we are looking at additional Garveys over the six-year period, for which those proceeds will go to Route 460 and the Coalfields Expressway PPTA. It does reflect, as John indicated in his presentation, the loss of federal revenue for both the maintenance and the construction program. Now, one thing that is a little different is that we actually have a little less state revenue in this six-year window, in that MAP 21 provides DOTs to now match more of the federal dollars with what we call soft match versus actual state allocation. So that allows us to use federal funds at 100% level. through our toll credits. There are a couple of other items that I'd like to address in this update to get your consensus regarding two impacts from MAP 21. MAP 21 consolidated several funding categories, which resulted in the elimination of a dedicated federal funding program for bridge and what we call the Appalachian Development Highway System, and I'll call it APD. It's just several terms to describe the same thing. Though the off-system bridge funding, or BROS, is still retained in MAP 21 as a set-aside of the STP funding category. One of the CTB's funding priorities has been deficient bridges. We've been focusing a lot of our discretionary money on deficient bridges. Without the dedicated bridge funding category, bridges will now be competing with all other highway projects for federal funding. What I would like to recommend is that we look at a commitment for bridge and APD funding through using MAP 21, but have it be an internal commitment to maintain those levels, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. In fiscal year 2013 through 2018, the federal dedicated bridge funding was an average of about 13% of the federal funds in construction and maintenance. The APD or ADHS funding was on average 4% of that similar federal construction and maintenance funding. Now, to narrow down to the bridge component, to keep the funding of deficient bridges as a priority, we would like to recommend a prioritization by this board of a commitment to an average of 13% of total federal funds be maintained over the 6 years for deficient bridge projects in the 14 through 19 program.
Rita?
Yes, sir.
I'm always concerned about, I'm going to use the term arbitrary, I don't necessarily mean that negative, but we put out a percentage. Now, 13% may be the right number. It may be 15, it may be 12. Why target a specific percentage versus we've got a number of things, whether they're bridges or roads, that need to be addressed, and just looking at them from the standpoint, I mean, do we do a bridge when there could have been something else that was a bigger safety problem or a bigger transportation need, or do we do something else when a bridge was a bigger transportation need just because we have this 13% number? Why target that?
Within the new rules of MAP 21, what we had programmed for a safety lieu and back when there was a specific federal dedicated amount, we've been putting other federal discretionary money on bridges. We have projects that are funded through in 13-18. They're already on projects, some of them in various stages of development. We didn't want to make a decision to pull any money off of the existing commitment of bridges across the state.
But
now,
you're going forward beyond. Essentially, I would assume you're going to use this as a guideline in 2026, theoretically.
Until the next federal authorization comes out, we'll look at what the new rules are. But I don't think we're ever going to get another six-year federal authorization. I think the point being, even with the federal bridge funding, we were using other discretionary money and putting it on bridge projects since it was a priority. That didn't mean we didn't fund other safety issues, though we get a larger, in MAP 21, we do get a larger share of safety, a separate allocation for safety, which we usually call HSIP. So there is additional funding in the safety category still as a dedicated amount of funding. We just saw it as a commitment that would let the districts know that we, in this update, wouldn't be needing to pull money off of bridges just because there was no dedicated funding category. And again, it's an internal commitment that can shift when a time comes when that it's not necessary to continue at that level. But this level has been helping us maintain our performance measure of 8%. And going forward, as you've heard some of the MPOs indicate, we will be, FHWA or USDOT is now guiding us to more performance measures for the state, including any efforts by localities and MPOs. So we wanted to make sure we were able to maintain our performance ranking going forward.
And Rita, what are the consequences if we don't?
Just maybe not able to put as many bridges into replacement or reconstruction.
Rita, is the money going away or is it just shifting to what it's being called?
It is actually, the money has not gone away. What's happened is it is now captured in a new funding category called NHPP, and it's up to the DOT to determine what portion that NHPP consolidates three previous funding categories: interstate maintenance, bridge set aside, and National Highway System or NHS funding into one large pot. And that pot is to be used, that federal pot is to be used to fund any kind of improvement or expansion or reconstruction on national highway system routes.
Okay, so in other words, in the past, we didn't have to decide to devote that money to bridges because it was already previously allocated or designated for bridges. And what you're saying is it has averaged 13% in the past, and you're just asking us to keep that category maintained at the same level it was because it's being recategorized by the federal government.
I think we still want to make it a priority and to do that and to let people see how, where it is being programmed, that you can see that we're at the same level, that we're keeping that commitment, and for the districts and the localities to see that commitment as well. I will tell you that for several years, we've been actually putting more money than the federal set aside on bridges, that when we had discretionary money for bridges available.
Yes, to Mr. Sterling's comment, if we came back tomorrow, say next year, and we found that we're, you know, for some odd reason, a bunch of new bridges were structurally deficient, and of course, when we use that terminology, it doesn't mean they're getting ready to fall down, but the public might well perceive that that's what it means. Would you come back and say change the percentage?
I'd rather not have to keep changing that. I think if you still have a priority, we would then be looking for other types of funding to put on bridges, I would say. This was to give those projects that are currently in the program an internal set aside to keep them funded, a holding place.
I guess, and I don't want to speak for courts, particularly since you've not, maybe I should. I just want it to be realistic. You know, I mean, I don't care whether the number's 12 or 10 or 19. I want it to be realistic for what we plan to do, given our needs and the priorities that we set. So we may not do some bridges because something else is more of a safety hazard or more important. And I just want our plan to reflect that at the end of the day. I think that's what he was getting at.
And I agree.
So to sort of balk at a fixed percent is somehow that's reality. I want it to be, and I'm not saying it's not.
No, I appreciate that.
Yeah, if I got 12 things to do in my house, I add up the cost and I decide which ones are which, and it doesn't really matter whether it's 13% or whether it's 12% or 18%. I do the one that's needed most first, and then when I run out of money, I stop.
Okay, thank you.
And I think the federal law gives us the flexibility.
It does.
This measure of,
as long as we keep our eye on that ball as well, then
absolutely. The slide goes on to indicate how much in the 13 through 18 program of the federal dollars was actually put on bridges and what that might look like. With the federal revenue reduction that we're facing, a little over $700 million, it would be $591 million in this 6 years. And again, as I mentioned, we felt it critical to continue to focus on that as a performance measure area. The MAP 21 impact for the ADHS, it also, MAP 21 does eliminate the set-aside for the ADHS projects. Though USDOT still sees that as a commitment and a desire to complete the corridors in each of the 13 states that have been identified for ADHS funding. The previous set-aside was based on the proposed mileage of the three corridors associated with Virginia, which was Corridor B, H, and Q. This level of funding has been maintained, but it's now in the new categories. Some of the money is in the NHPP funding category, and some of the money is in the STP funding category, but they're no longer setting a level of defining that level of set-aside. MAP 21 is requiring, within a year of its approval by the President, requiring a formal plan from the DOTs as to how and when we plan to complete our corridors, and that includes not only the funding but the timing. As I indicate, Corridor B is complete and we're working on Corridor Q right now. Corridor H is a commitment after Corridor Q is completed. Our concern is that any one of these corridors, if it's not in our plan to USDOT, funding may be taken from us due to the fact that it was given to us by mileage-based for the three corridors. We are recommending maintaining the average percentage of federal funds in fiscal year 2013 through 2018 for ADHS projects to carry that forward to the 14 through 19 program, and that represented about 14% of the federal funding in maintenance and construction. In 13 through 18, that was about $215 million. In 14 through 19, it would be approximately $182 million. And this would keep us on course to complete the planned projects. It just may take a couple more years in the out years to complete it with the reduced funding.
Chairman? Yes. Rita, could you be so kind as to when, as you're putting this further together, especially for the new members, but I include myself, a glossary of these terms.
I absolutely will.
Okay.
My first 6 months at VDOT, I had to write everything down because I didn't get it.
Harold sent it to me last time, Gary.
We produced, or the staff produced that glossary when I came here because I asked for the same thing. I think Carol.
We'll send it out again.
I was thinking,
especially as it pertains to
6 years again with MAP 21.
This is Gary. I need a brief meeting. I got tired of asking because I'm the only one who asked him one of these, and I'm about time somebody else looked like him.
Fair enough. The priorities that I'm showing on this slide are the priorities that we've carried forward for the last few programs to confirm with you all that we're in a similar place and these are still relevant priorities for the update of this program. The only two differences would be that we are showing a potential commitment to deficient bridges and the ADH funding that I just mentioned. For those of you that maybe have not seen these, our first order of priority is to fund any deficits on projects that are underway. For whatever reason, if there's been a cost change or increase that requires additional funding because it's underway, that's definitely a first priority. Second priority would be to fund underway project phases as well as project phases that start in the current federal fiscal year, and that's to get us to our third strategy or priority, which is to maximize our use of federal funds to meet federal strategy, which is to obligate all of our federal funds in the federal fiscal year so that we will continue to receive federal funds at the existing level and potentially receive additional federal funds at the end of the fiscal year that some other state perhaps did not use. Our previous comment in terms of prioritization was funding deficient bridges and paving projects. There was no percentage or amount to that. I would like to keep that on there. If you would not like to put the ADHS percentage or the percentage for deficient bridges, maybe we can just highlight that as a change and to focus on it in the update. Any preference to that change? We also want to maintain our focus on increasing funding for preliminary engineering to keep projects in the queue, to keep new projects coming on board over the 6 years, to keep the use of federal funding and other resources going. We've had the support for development of PPTA projects. And very important in the time when we have not had as many resources as we needed, that we allocate funds consistent with how they will be obligated and expended, meaning we're not front-loading funding on projects. We put the allocations on the projects based on their development cycle and their estimates so that the funding is there when it's needed for the next phase of a project. And any projects that have been completed or are inactive and will not be moving forward, to redirect those inactive balances to projects that will move forward to maximize efficient use of resources and maximize federal funding. Are you all comfortable with these priorities for the update of the program? Keeping in mind right now we don't know exactly what our resources.
I know these are priorities, but do these numbers change, which I think you're showing about based on Mr. Lawson's update of $700 million being reduced, or is that included in your?
They're included in my number in that it's reflected if you look at slide 4.
So that's part of it.
I've taken that into account when you're looking at one set of 6 years compared to the next 6 years.
That's been reduced.
Right.
Rita, just to respond, the only thing that I would sort of say other than the maintenance comments I've made, which has got to be our first priority in general, the support development of PPTAs, I think that depends for me on what the PPTA is. So it's not a blanket thing from my way of looking at it. I'm going to be interested in looking at them one at a time.
Absolutely. And they would come to you prior to any inclusion in a 6-year program.
Sort of a general comment, support PPTAs. My specific would be I'll support them when I see each one.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to simply speak to and in favor of including the internal discipline of the 13%, it's my understanding that our Commonwealth has a large number of bridges, more so than many states, and we do have that obligation to keep those bridges safe and maintained. And while since this is an internal discipline, we have the opportunity to look at it every year when we look at this plan, and in as much as heretofore we had planned to maintain a 13% spending discipline for maintaining those bridges, I would suggest that maybe we at least for this year keep that number in there, and we can look at it and review it each year as we come forward.
Okay. One more slide that I'd like to review is the schedule for the update of the program. In this time frame, we're bringing you the kickoff, some of reviewing the priorities. We're providing some information, or will be shortly, to the MPOs related to RSDP and CMAQ funding. We're asking for MPOs and PDCs to provide us any updated priorities, and some of which you've heard today. We will, normally we plan to bring back a draft of the update of the program in April. Depending on what the General Assembly may do, it may be as late as May, but we hope to stick to April since we're getting a little bit of a late start. And then we would have our regional public hearings in the May-June timeframe, or April-May timeframe, and then in June we'd bring back the final program amended for any changes you would like to make for adoption at the June board meeting, and then it becomes effective July 1.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Next agenda item would be the Interstate 64 Peninsula study. Angel Dean.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the board. My name is Angel Deem, and I'm here to present the outcomes to date for the location study for the I-64 Peninsula study. It's documented in a draft environmental impact statement that's out and it's been reviewed. It's a 75-mile corridor from the city of Richmond to the city of Hampton. It includes the counties of Henrico, New Kent, James City, and York, and the cities of Richmond, Newport News, and Hampton. So this slide is familiar to you. It's one that we use just to convey the elements of the location study process and also to show where we've been with this study and where we're headed. So we initiated the study in January of 2011, got started with scoping and other kickoff initiatives geared at developing the purpose and need for the project. We held agency and citizen information meetings in March of 2011 to receive feedback on purpose and need elements. We then got into the alternative development process to look at a reasonable range of alternatives to meet the needs of this diverse corridor. We again held a series of agency and citizen information meetings that time in April of last year. We worked on technical studies. We have 10 technical reports that support the draft environmental impact statement. In October of last year, Federal Highway signed the draft EIS for public review and comment. That comment period then initiated and concluded on January the 7th. We held also location public hearings in December of last year. Looking ahead, following today's briefing and next month's selection of a preferred alternative by the board, we'll begin the work on the final environmental impact statement, which will be focused on that preferred alternative as well as addressing comments received on the draft. We hope to have that final submitted in November of this year, and then following that, Federal Highway's issuance of a record of decision in early 2014. So a little bit about the purpose and need analysis for the corridor. Again, this was developed through review of technical studies, our own analyses, as well as input from agencies and the public. The purpose and need elements is shown here, capacity, roadway deficiencies, and safety. I would just note that today the existing volumes, or 2011 volumes, show that approximately 64% of this corridor operates at a deficient level of service on the main line, and about 56% of the interchange operate at a deficient level of service. If we forecast out to 2040, as we did, and if no actions are taken in the corridor, those percentages go up to 89% deficient level of service on the main line and 96% deficient level of service at the interchanges. So some significant challenges in the corridor. As we looked at alternatives and evaluated the existing conditions, one of our overarching goals with this study was to look at improvements that could be accommodated within the existing right-of-way to the extent practicable. We also divided the 75-mile corridor into three distinct regions or sections. Region 1 being an urban interstate that today has approximately 6 lanes. Region 2 being a rural interstate that exists today as a 4-lane section. And Region 3, again, another urban section that has approximately 8 lanes. And our level of service goal for this study was level service C, to look at improvements that would bring us to level service C or better by 2040. The range of preliminary alternatives, of course, we maintain the the no build or no action alternative. We also looked at TSM and TDM, passenger and freight rail. We looked at the existing studies that are out there. We also looked at highway build alternative, general purpose lanes, as well as managed lanes. And the alternatives that have been studied in detail in the draft EIS are the no build and five highway build options. Essentially, alternative one adds general purpose lanes. There's two variations, putting those lanes to the outside and putting those lanes to the median. So that's the 1A, 1B. Alternative two adds additional lanes and tolls all lanes. Again, adding A being adding them to the outside and B to the inside. Alternative three is the managed lane alternative, which assumes median widening.
While we're on this topic here, looking at the alternatives, looking at the other picture of that discretion line, it's pretty clear that, I mean, it's a large project, but there are different needs along the corridor.
Right.
When you look at breaking the projects up, is that consideration, particularly when you consider the monies, I mean, is there a way that maybe we don't need alternative 1A, whatever we decide on the whole way, different areas? Have you looked at that?
We have not yet. The goal we were given, there have been studies to look at pieces of this corridor, and the objective we were given was to look at the entire 75 miles for an improvement concept from Richmond to Hampton Roads. However, as you'll note in one of the slides that is forthcoming, there is the potential to phase construction. So yes, as we move into the final, if it's the desire of the board to look closer at that, we can certainly accommodate that. And I think in a practical sense, that will be how the project is implemented.
Because I know the governor's plan and Delegate Watkins, they have suggested some things that seem to make some sense in terms of, obviously the overall scope. But anyway, you answered my question. Mm-hmm. We have the opportunity to break this up if deemed appropriate, at least from the standpoint of cost or what have
you. Correct. And you could look at the alternative selected could be a vision for the corridor, but then certainly could be phased and looked at more closely with each section.
Okay.
So this is just a graphic that shows a representative section, no particular section of the corridor, that just allows you to visualize the placement of the lanes within the existing right-of-way. So the red line depicts that existing right-of-way. On the left, that shows where the lanes are added to the outside. And the middle shows the median widening, and to the right is the managed lane option. Just would note that the managed lane alternative, again, alternative three, can be the addition of managed lanes both with and without general purpose lanes. It's fairly broad in that respect. And it could also be implemented in sections or for the full corridor.
I noticed when you do the managed lanes, you don't look at the managed outside versus the inside. Obviously, the current lanes could become the managed lanes, probably, and you could add to the outside versus the median. Is it true that it's generally less expensive? I mean, I would think it's generally less expensive to go to the median. There's no additional land that necessarily has to be acquired.
Right. I think here, maybe that's not the case as would typically be, because so much of the improvement can be accommodated within the existing right-of-way, even with the outside widening. The other problem with adding the managed lanes, doing an outside widening and using the existing lanes for managed lanes, are the reversible managed lanes at the eastern end of the corridor. That's problematic. Not that it couldn't be done in other parts of the corridor, but at that end, it would be challenging.
Chairman, in response to Mr. Miller's question, the other part of it is, if you've got to buy a right-of-way at some point, it's never going to be cheaper than it is today, and some would say you might be better off reserving the inside because you already own the right-of-way.
Sure.
And buy the right-of-way at as cheap a price as you can right now.
But I would, as I mentioned, I would just reinforce that our managed lane option did assume widening to the median. So if there's any desire to look at some derivation of that, we could certainly take it into account. So this chart is just a snapshot of the environmental impact matrix that's presented in the document, and we did just pick some resource categories that are usually of interest. And all I would say, rather than going through each of these unless you have questions, is I think this representative sample shows what you'll see in the larger impact assessment, and that is that the impacts are very comparable, if not the same, across all the alternatives. And the reason for that, again, is because most of the improvement is within the existing right-of-way, and because the interchange footprints or impact areas, I should say, are the same for all alternatives. So we didn't change the alternative impact area by alternative. Another consideration for alternatives, not resource categories. Some of these are fairly intuitive, but I just wanted to point them out. All five build alternatives meet purpose and need. All possess the potential for phased construction. Alternative 2 and 3 possess the potential for revenue generation. And then as a caveat, I just would mention for the outside widening concepts, 1A and 2A, the Navy has told us very clearly that there's a five-mile section where that would not be possible. I want to make note of that. And, of course, for Alternative 2, a change in current federal law and regulation would be required in order to implement Alternative 2 as we studied it. Not knowing what MAP 21 would provide, we decided to include the all-toll option just to have that analysis in hand. Okay, for these two slides, I provided a handout, a larger scale, because this is really difficult to view in the PowerPoint. So what you have are four sheets that just show you the variable improvement concept by sections of the corridor, because it's not, even though in general the lanes that are needed match up to those three sections I described, but there are some changes to that. So as you look at the handout, you'll see what the needs are with the outside widening and inside widening, and then the managed lane widening. So this graphic, which is in the document, which you have as a handout, shows you exactly what the number of lanes are that are needed through the various sections by direction. Public hearing summary. Again, the public hearings were held in mid-December. We had over 200 people in attendance. The comment period ended, as I said, at the beginning of January, and we received a total of 130 comments, and those were received by the comment sheets that we prepared, as well as emails, letters, and oral comments. 11 comments were received from local governments and other agencies, and I just highlight a couple of those. Two of the federal agencies just asked for some additional information in the final. They wanted to see comparison of impacts, if we assumed bridging of streams and wetlands, things like that. They also asked for additional justification for eliminating some alternatives that we had eliminated, et cetera. The City of Newport News sent a letter in support of the project and urged our implementation of it. James City County supports Alternative 1A, so that's the general purpose lane widening to the outside, acknowledging that an improvement is needed regardless of the alternative chosen. York County supported Alternative 1A, emphasizing the need to maintain the aesthetic character of the median. However, they recognized in their letter that 1B may be most practical, so that's the median widening. They did not favor the use of tolls. So that's the highlight of some of the comments received.
Have you received comments from the Hampton Roads TPO or the Richmond MPO?
We received comments from the Hampton Roads TPO. They were primarily editorial in nature, making some corrections to statements in the draft. They did not favor a particular alternative.
Are we expecting any more? Because I'm hearing that we're supposed to take action on this in March, and there are still some more comments.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to get those in before we're asked to?
My understanding is that the Richmond MPO is going to provide feedback directly to the board, that their timing of meetings and such didn't allow them to do so by the end of the comment period. They actually submitted last week a set of questions to us, which we've provided answers to facilitate their comments.
Well, I would ask that we not be asked to make a decision until we've had those comments vetted by you guys and worked into your recommendation.
Okay.
I mean, I think that would be, these are the two people using it, so if that's not available by March, I would ask you to consider making that in April before you come back to us.
Okay.
Yes, can I ask a question of both Mr. Lane and Mr. Cole? I guess it's your districts involved. Is this generally has support? I'm not talking about specific alternatives, but some kind of improvement to 64 runs a common thread that everybody's for it in one fashion.
Yes, I'll build on that, Mr. Cole. Yes, the answer is, and that goes back to my comments about can it be broken up, or there are other alternatives. In other words, knowing that this is a huge amount of money.
Okay, but the consensus is...
we got to do it, and we're just trying to say, let's be more pragmatic, and if we can get a better solution instead of something that we've asked us to work on until we get all the comments, I think.
And you're correct, Aubrey. In Richmond, although, again, we haven't had a lot of commentary regarding which alternative is appropriate, I think we are hearing a consensus that the no-build alternative is not, in fact, an alternative. And I share the same concerns that Mr. Lane does in terms of our timing. This just doesn't, the decisions that we need to make are not just housed at the MPO level. They go down to the jurisdiction level and actually down to the district level in some cases to schools and blocks and, housing that's being affected. So you've got that on one hand. And on the other hand, you've got some very rural counties that are impacted that may not have the resources to deal with the questions as quickly. So let's just be sure if we've got all the information, all of their input, there's no reason to hold back, but I would certainly.
And the two entities that have asked us questions that we've responded to, again, are the Richmond MPO and the City of Richmond, and we've provided those responses.
Right. Gary, I would tell you, I would imagine that the level of demand from the Hampton Roads TPO would be bigger than the Richmond one, because Hampton Roads is at the end of the line, and that's their way to get out. The Richmond folks that are coming to Hampton Roads, they're sort of coming to one place, Hampton Roads or perhaps the Outer Banks, but everybody in Hampton Roads to get out, to go anywhere, is either going that way, 460, or perhaps up 13.
Well, I think it's just refreshing that you have a consensus for something, because we don't usually have that in Northern
Virginia. It's got to be the number. That's got to be the next thing done of many magnitude in Hampton.
Yeah,
right?
It's a huge, it's huge demand.
Okay.
Thank
you. So you see the responses provided there. Those are metrics from the comment sheets where it lists 31 in support of this alternative, 37 in support of another. That's where those metrics came from. And then you'll see the split when asked about tolling as a way to finance the project. It was 40 in support and 51 not in support of the comments where folks answered that question.
And
okay. So... the next step would be to return next month for a decision on the locally preferred alternative or the preferred alternative study and the final. Of course, hearing the input received today. And again, as I stated earlier, November target for submission of the final EIS and then the record of decision following that.
And with that schedule, we'll take the your comments in consideration.
We haven't heard from them, and they've got consensus. I'm not going to recommend we take a position.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
What I'd like to do, the Secretary is still working with the General Assembly, and we have a number of competing demands right now. And I thought that maybe we'll suspend the workshop. We still have two items left. I thought we could suspend the workshop and then go into the action part of the meeting, take those items. If we have time, we can come back and get the last two items on the workshop. And if it's your concurrence, I thought we could break now for lunch. I'm going to start with the action item in about 15 minutes.
You get